very interesting new technology that apparently offers an opportunity for even more effective immunization and antibody response. All of those stories and more are on today's bonus show. Get instant access by signing up at joinpacman.com. Coupon code Dystopian Rally. All one word, all lowercase.
Hi, this is Dean from Luna. You're listening to 88.3 FM WRCT in Pittsburgh.
WRCT Pittsburgh. We love monkeys.
Hey there, folks. Glad you could join me for all the best. The smoothest of the smooth, the cool and gentle sounds of what we call jazz.
Tired of the fluffy stuff? At WRCT Pittsburgh, jazz is awesome.
You're listening to WRCT Feedback Radio.
Soon, pay toilets will take over the world, and everyone, everywhere will listen to WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM.
This is Satan. You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM.
Hovland, you're listening to 88.3 WRCT FM, Pittsburgh.
Pittsburgh. This is Danny Glover, and you're listening to 88.3 FM WRCT Pittsburgh.
WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM, rock.
WRCT Pittsburgh, we won't respect you anymore.
You listening in at your house? Are you listening in at your car? If you want to hear good music, you don't have to go far. 88.3 is the magic number. WRCT in at the Pittsburgh area. Who says so? I say so. Who is me? Maccabee Selassie.
WRCT Pittsburgh, music for your inner robot.
Would you like to take the sounds of your favorite radio station to places you never thought possible? Well, now you can, because WRCT is live on the internet. Just point your browser to www.wrct.org and click on our live MP3 broadcast. Now you can go out of town without any feelings of loss or regret for leaving us behind, because we're just a mouse click away. WRCT, live on the internet. Because why should Pittsburgh have all the fun?
Hey, this is Marlon Saunders, and you're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM.
Hey, this is Jim from Rusted Root, and you're listening to WRCT 88.3 in Pittsburgh. Yeah.
Hey, this is Steve Archer.
And Donna Lynch.
From Ego Likeness, you're listening to WRCT Radio.
Yeah, well, this is Kimon Marlon, and you're listening to WRCT FM. Keep it locked.
WRCT Pittsburgh, meaty and full of flavor since 1940.
We at WRCT Pittsburgh do not condone the illegal duplication of copyrighted material. But if you happen to own all the tracks we played and would like a copy of them, just FTP to FTP.
Due to a request by computing services, the remainder of this announcement cannot be.
WRCT Pittsburgh, we're always here for you.
I'm from creationist crucifixion!
Arr, I'm not attractive and I'm from Steel Curtain.
Me neither, arr.
WRCT.
Pittsburgh, 88.3, arr.
This is WRCT. This is WRCT. Come on and stay with us a while. Big 900 on your dial. We'll make your day a great big smile. WRCT.
WRCT, Pittsburgh.
Yeah, that's where things like this go, right down the drain.
Senator John McCain, and I'm from Arizona. But when I'm in Pittsburgh, I always listen to WRCT, one of the finest stations in all of radio, and Carnegie Mellon University is one of the finest academic institutions in our country. Be sure at your next election to vote early and vote often.
Collins from Late Show with David.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
Today's verdict brings an end to Robert Kelly's decade-long reign of terror over many vulnerable girls, boys, and young women.
R&B singer R. Kelly is found guilty of being a sexual predator and trafficker after nearly a dozen survivors testified about his abuse of dozens of black women and underage girls for nearly two decades. We'll speak with Dream Hampton, executive producer of the documentary series Surviving R. Kelly, that first helped give a platform to Kelly's accusers. Then we go inside the CIA's secret plans to kill or kidnap Julian Assange.
We found that in the early months of 2017, the CIA mounted a secret all-out war on WikiLeaks that included plans to snatch or abduct the group's founder, Julian Assange, to sow discord among his associates, to monitor their communications, and to steal their electronic devices. There were also discussions inside the CIA about possibly even assassinating him.
And we go to Chicago, where workers at El Milagro Tortilla Plant staged a temporary walkout to protest low pay and abuse of working conditions.
All we're doing is demanding our rights as employees of El Milagro. Just as they have rights as employers, we too have rights as workers. I pack 80 tortilla packages per minute. I load a case, put it on a pallet, and come right back. Because if I don't keep up this pace, the tortillas will fall off from the machine and they'll blame me.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Senate Republicans voted unanimously Monday to block a House-approved bill that would fund the federal government and raise the ceiling on the national debt. The vote came just days before a September 30th deadline to avert a government shutdown. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer said Republicans' actions were threatening to plunge the U.S. into a recession.
Our country is staring down the barrel of two totally Republican-manufactured disasters, a government shutdown and a first-ever default on the national debt. The impact of both would gravely harm every single American in this country.
Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen has notified Congress that unless it acts before mid-October to raise the debt ceiling, the U.S. government will default on its debts. Arizona Democratic Senator Kyrsten Sinema has scheduled to hold a fundraiser today with five business lobbying groups that oppose a massive spending bill containing some of the Biden administration's top legislative priorities. That's according to the New York Times, which reports those in attendance are being asked to write checks for up to $5,800 to Senator Sinema's campaign. She says she opposes the spending bill's price tag of $3.5 trillion over 10 years. The legislation would increase taxes on wealthy individuals and corporations in order to expand the social safety net, improve worker rights, and combat the climate crisis. Sinema's support is critical to Democrats' plans to use a budget reconciliation bill to pass the legislation in the evenly divided Senate. Jurors in the federal trial against accused sexual predator and trafficker R. Kelly, a famous R&B singer, found him guilty Monday of charges including racketeering based on sexual exploitation of children, kidnapping, forced labor, and sex trafficking. Nearly a dozen survivors and over 30 other witnesses detailed R. Kelly's pattern of sexual and other abuse against dozens of women and underage girls for nearly two decades. It's a landmark verdict for the Me Too movement. After headlines, we'll speak with Dream Hampton, executive producer of the six-part documentary series Surviving R. Kelly. She broke open the case. The United States reported nearly 2,400 new COVID-19 deaths on Monday, even as hospitalizations continued to decline from a peak in early September. President Biden publicly received a booster shot of Pfizer's COVID-19 vaccine Monday, just days after federal regulators authorized third doses for immunocompromised people, frontline workers, and people age 65 and older. Biden, who is 78 years old, received his third injection in a White House event where he called on tens of millions of eligible U.S. residents to get vaccinated.
Over 77% of adults have gotten at least one shot. About 23% haven't gotten any shots. And that distinct minority is causing an awful lot of us damage for the rest of the country.
Here in New York, thousands of hospital and nursing home workers rushed to get their first COVID-19 shots ahead of a vaccine mandate deadline at midnight Monday. New York health officials say the late surge means at least 92% of healthcare workers have received at least one dose. Those who've refused face unpaid leaves of absence or termination. New York Governor Kathy Hochul said she's prepared to deploy the National Guard to help fill any staffing shortages.
Today is a significant deadline. It reflects my priority to stop this virus dead in its tracks. We are over it. We are done. We want to move on. And the only way we can do that is to ensure that everyone is vaccinated, but particularly individuals who are taking care of the people who are sick.
On Monday, a three-judge federal appeals court panel ruled New York City may proceed with a vaccine mandate for nearly all public school workers. Top officials in the Trump administration's Central Intelligence Agency discussed kidnapping and assassinating WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange while he took refuge in the Ecuadorian embassy in London in 2017. That's according to an explosive new expose in Yahoo News, which cites over 30 former officials. They describe how then-CIA Director Mike Pompeo sought revenge over WikiLeaks' publication of sensitive CIA hacking tools called Vault 7, which the agency considered the largest data loss in CIA history. Later in the broadcast, we'll speak with Mike Isikoff, chief investigative correspondent for Yahoo News, and human rights attorney Jennifer Robinson, who's been advising Julian Assange and WikiLeaks since 2010. The International Criminal Court's lead prosecutor said Monday he's seeking approval to resume his investigation into war crimes committed in Afghanistan by the Taliban and the militant group ISIS-K. Notably absent from the ICC statement was any mention of alleged war crimes committed by the United States, its allies, and the former U.S.-backed government in Kabul. Patricia Grossman of Human Rights Watch tweeted in response, "It seems there's no end to the betrayal of Afghans. Now, so many victims of torture and other abuses by U.S. and former Afghan government forces have been told there is no justice for you," she said. Meanwhile, the Taliban-appointed chancellor for Kabul University said Monday all women would be indefinitely barred from attending courses, either as professors or students. And Afghanistan's first of its kind women's driving school reports business has ground to a halt since the Taliban takeover in August.
Since the previous government collapsed, we have not registered a single new student. And also, no one has contacted us to get a registration. The previously admitted students are calling us and asking if they can join their classes, but they are worried about their security.
In Tunisia, over 100 senior officials with the country's largest political party have resigned, protesting President Kais Saied's ousting of the Tunisian prime minister and a suspension of parliament in July. Opponents are decrying an attempted coup after Saied gave himself executive authority. On Sunday, thousands of protesters gathered in the capital, Tunis, demanding Saied step down.
He is acting like he is the sun that is rising on the country. The general prosecutor, the president, the parliament, the government, like he is everything. Even his authority that revised the constitutional laws. It is like he is saying, "I am your God Almighty." That is what it means. No, this must be removed. The Tunisian people deserve better than this.
In immigration news, the Biden administration's issued a new rule that seeks to modify DACA, that's the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, in an effort to preserve and protect the temporary relief program from future legal challenges. This comes after a Texas federal judge in July struck down DACA, arguing the program exceeded President Obama's authority when it was created through executive action in 2012. July's ruling blocked new DACA applications. DACA has provided temporary protection from deportation and work authorization to some 800,000 undocumented people who were brought to the U.S. as children. Filmmaker Melvin Van Peebles, praised as the godfather of modern black cinema, died in New York last week at the age of 89. Peebles is best known for his iconic 1971 film Sweet Sweet Back's Badass Song, which is credited with launching the blaxploitation movie genre. Peebles was also an actor, a novelist, a playwright, and composer. And prominent Native American filmmaker, journalist, and professor Myron Dewey died Sunday in a car crash in Nevada. He was 49 years old. Dewey was the founder of the media production company Digital Smoke Signals, which shared live footage from the front lines of the resistance to the Dakota Access Pipeline at Standing Rock. Democracy Now! Met Dewey in North Dakota in 2016 as he faced a misdemeanor stalking charge for using a drone to take video of unlicensed private pipeline security workers. Those charges would ultimately be dropped.
There's an arrest warrant for me stalking the Dakota Access Pipeline security, which these are the guys that had no badges, no names, no license plates. So it's a little intimidating when you see these guys looking like Navy SEALs in the back. You know, when you're traveling, when you're documenting. You know, I came as a filmmaker and digital storyteller, and I'm leaving now as an environmental justice filmmaker and journalist.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez in New Brunswick, New Jersey. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
Well, a warning to our viewers and listeners. Today's top segment contains graphic descriptions of sexual abuse. Sexual predator and trafficker R. Kelly, the famous R&B singer, was found guilty Monday of a series of charges, including racketeering based on sexual exploitation of children, kidnapping, forced labor, and transporting people across state lines for sex. Kelly's sentencing is scheduled for May next year. He faces decades in prison. 11 accusers, 9 women and 2 men, and 34 other witnesses detailed Kelly's pattern of sexual and other abuse against dozens of women and underage girls for nearly 2 decades. This is Acting U.S. Attorney Jacqueline Casula speaking outside the Brooklyn Federal Courthouse.
Today's guilty verdict forever brands R. Kelly as a predator who used his fame and fortune to prey on the young, the vulnerable, and the voiceless for his own sexual gratification. A predator who used his inner circle to ensnare underage girls and young men and women for decades in a sordid web of sex abuse, exploitation, and humiliation. To the victims in this case, your voices were heard and justice was finally served. This conviction would not have been possible without the bravery and resilience of R. Kelly's victims. I applaud their courage in revealing in open court the painful, intimate, and horrific details of their lives with him.
Monday's guilty verdict comes after years of allegations R. Kelly had abused minors, including as far back as 1994 when he married then 15-year-old R&B singer, the late Aaliyah. She died in a plane crash. He was arrested in 2002 and accused of making a recording of himself sexually abusing and urinating on a 14-year-old girl. It was the remarkable docuseries Surviving R. Kelly that helped give a platform to his accusers. black women and girls. The first witness to testify in R. Kelly's latest trial was Jahunda Pace, who described how she was sexually and physically abused by Kelly when she was 16 years old. In this clip from Surviving R. Kelly, she says she was 15 when she met Kelly in 2008 outside his child pornography trial.
I went to his trial because I was a super fan at the time. I didn't believe he was guilty, and I didn't want to believe that he was guilty. I was a freshman in high school. He was old for me to like him, but I fell in love with his music. After Robert's trial, his friend sent me a message and invited me to R. Kelly's party. And in the middle of me texting him back, Rob, he actually called my phone. And he was telling me, he said, I remember you. And I said, well, what do you remember me from? He said, you came to my trial. Thank you for your support. I was shocked. I felt like I was on top of the world.
That was survivor Jahunda Pace, who says she was later sexually, mentally, and physically abused while living in a cult-like atmosphere in R. Kelly's home when she was 16. Pace testified, quote, he wanted me to put my hair up in pigtails and dress like a Girl Scout, and said, quote, he recorded us having sexual intercourse. Pace also testified that Kelly gave her herpes and never told her he had a sexually transmitted disease. She responded to the verdict Monday, writing in part, I'm thankful to stand with those who were brave enough to speak up. I'm happy to finally close this chapter of my life. I testified and the jury found him guilty. No matter what you think of me or how you feel about things, today I made history. I want to see you be brave, she said. Meanwhile, cases against R. Kelly have also been filed in Illinois and Minnesota. For more, we go to Chicago to speak with Dream Hampton, executive producer of the six-part Lifetime documentary series Surviving R. Kelly, which won a Peabody Award and was nominated for an Emmy. Dream, welcome back to Democracy Now! You blew this case wide open. You're the reason this trial was held. Others found him not guilty. Can you respond to the guilty verdict on charge after charge?
I agree with Jahunda Pace. I mean, and let's look back at Jahunda's story. Like you just said in your recap, she was a high school student going to the courtroom in 2008 to support him during a trial where he's accused of child pornography, amongst other things. R. Kelly cruises a 10th grader. I mean, that's the hubris that this man had during his first trial, a trial that he was able to manipulate, first by putting it off for years, secondly, and most importantly, by keeping the victim close to him. She was a teenager who thought she was in love with him. But by delaying that first trial for so many years, he made sure that should she decide to testify against him, she would appear as a 20-year-old. So there were times when I was making Surviving R. Kelly that I had to deal with R. Kelly's own biography, which of course included incredibly painful sexual trauma. He himself, of course, is the victim of sexual abuse. But I had to also look at how deeply manipulative he was. After 2008, after that trial, he took to coercing women to write false confessions. And all of these things added up and escalated, quite frankly. He just became more egregious, more bold, you know, with the kinds of crimes that he was committing against Black girls and women. And it was time for it to end. And I'm so proud that, you know, Black girls like Jahunda Pace, now Black women, found the courage to sit for us underneath these hot lights for hours at a time, and to share her story, to reopen and relive that trauma, which is so hard. And I hope that this does begin a healing journey for them all. And not just the ones who sat for our camera. I talked to dozens of women to corroborate the women whose stories were on camera, who didn't want to come on camera.
And Dream, I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about the resistance that you encountered in terms of developing the series that you made, and also if you could talk about the reaction in the African American community over the years. If there's been a difference in how folks in the African-American community view the allegations and charges against R. Kelly versus the general population?
Yeah, I'll take the second question first. I mean, Black women are in the Black community, and Black women have led this fight for justice for decades. I think about someone like Jim DeRogatis, who has heroically stayed on this beat, and he depended on Black women coming forward, on trusting him, on opening up and sharing this incredibly painful abuse with him. I think about the founders of Mute R. Kelly, who worked to platform him, to sanction him, to boycott, to divest. I think about, you know, and so that's what I have to hold in my heart. I have been Black my whole life. I'm from Detroit. I know what rape culture is in my community, and I know what it is in the larger country, and quite frankly, in a global context. And it's exactly what the support of R. Kelly looks like. It is about disbelieving testimony after testimony over decades, quite frankly, of Black girls and women. If it means, you know, protecting a Black man from, quite frankly, an unjust criminal system. It's complicated when it comes to our community. It's incredibly complicated. So, yeah, and now I can't remember the first question. I'm sorry.
Oh, and the other issue was the resistance that you encountered in the making of your series.
Well, you know, we were working for Lifetime, and they have a particular audience, and I think that these women's testimony, in some ways, might have been enough for the network, but they were trying to do something different, they told me, with this documentary, and I'd hoped to bring in some of the systemic stuff. I didn't get resistance from the network, necessarily, but I could not get the president of Jive Records, Barry Weiss, for instance, to come on camera. I couldn't get people who worked at Jive Records, at R. Kelly's record label, who worked with him after, you know, this tape that Amy described in her opening of R. Kelly sexually abusing, raping a 14-year-old, Sparkle's niece, his R&B protege singer who, you know, sacrificed a career to step forward and testify against R. Kelly in 08 and speak up for her niece. So I wanted, while the women's testimonies were important, it was also important for me to have some corporate context. You know, we did get the cultural context in there, but it was important for me that we talk about the industry, and we never got around to that. Not just the industry. We did talk about some of the kind of systemic support that he had on the ground in Chicago, which included employing off-duty police officers, many of whom were still active in the force. Jamila King at BuzzFeed just wrote an incredible article last week about, you know, the cop who testified, Hood is his last name. Trying to defend R. Kelly, quite frankly, on the stand, but his testimony ended up helping the prosecutors. And so, and I had evidence of this as we were making the documentary, where a parent would call the CPD to get a wellness check. And we had testimony from people who'd been in the studio that the police called R. Kelly to give him a heads up that the police were coming on the behest of the parents to do a wellness check, and he was able to shuttle the girls out of the studio. So those, or the police would show up for a wellness check, ask, you know, someone at the front door if the girls were okay, and leave. So, I mean, and this is true for all victims of, you know, sexual and gender crimes. It's not going to the police and going to this system for justice is not some clear path. The police are often the abusers are in our community. Andrea Ritchie has done so much great work on this, as has Mary Pava. But it was complicated.
Dream Hampton, if you could talk about what happened to Aaliyah. He produced her first film, R. Kelly did. Age ain't nothing but a number. He would end up marrying her. She would die in a plane crash years later. But talk about the significance of her experience. When did he start with Aaliyah?
We have evidence that, like with Sparkle's niece, that you know, he began grooming Aaliyah possibly at 12, which is really hard to say, you know? You talk about age ain't nothing but a number. I mean, he's no Nabokov, but he authored that song, you know? R. Kelly is a songwriter. And so a lot of what R. Kelly has been doing for decades has been in the public. He called himself the Pied Piper. He famously, in a BET interview with Teray, when asked if he liked teenage girls, replied with, "What do you mean by teenage?" He mocked us by telling us that in this video in 2002, this rape tape that had gone viral in the streets pre-internet, that it was his brother on camera and not him. So in so many ways, we opened Surviving R. Kelly with a Facebook post of R. Kelly saying, "It's been 30 years. If y'all wanted to get me, y'all should have got me then." And, you know, I took that challenge, as did the entire team, Bree Miranda Bryant, Tamara Simmons, creative at Buna Murray. You know, we realized that, you know, the hubris was staggering. And I didn't think that this would lead to charges, I have to be honest. When charges began being announced in February, just a month after our documentary aired, I was gobsmacked. I did not think that it would lead to this. What I'd hoped that it would lead to was a reckoning that the public, that my community might reconsider, you know, their support of him and might look more deeply at rape culture overall in our communities.
I said the film of Aaliyah, yeah. I meant the song.
Of course.
But also if you could talk about, for the first time, young men coming forward who were abused as boys.
Yeah, I mean, I can't say that I was surprised given the reporting and the research that we did for Surviving R. Kelly. I would hope that the gender of his victims, R. Kelly was a young male victim himself of sexual abuse and rape. I would hope that the gender of the victims wouldn't have an effect on whether or not R. Kelly supporters and fans continue to support him. I would want to believe that Black girls matter, that Black women matter. But I know that, you know, sometimes homophobia trumps our care for Black children, you know? And this isn't just a Black issue. I just happen to be a Black woman who, you know, lives in Black community and works in Black community, writing about a genre artist who performs R&B mostly for Black people. So that is who I'm caring about when I do this work.
And Dream, there are still trials that he must face in Illinois and Minnesota as well, and his sentencing won't be on this federal case. Conviction won't be until May. What do you expect will happen in Illinois, Minnesota? Are the charges there different from the ones he's faced that he just recently faced?
You know, I've not been keeping up with the trial, and the court proceedings, of course, were closed in New York. I didn't travel to New York to witness. But when I think about the reporting that we did for Surviving R. Kelly, I think about someone like Susan Loggins, an attorney in Chicago, who, you know, settled case after case for, I don't want to say for R. Kelly, but had victim after victim, Black women in Chicago mostly, signing non-disclosure agreements and receiving a pittance for restitution. I want to call it restitution. And restitution is owed, by the way. I mean, these are women who are going to need the kind of support that only money can begin to solve and help with. But I look at, you know, the people who weren't called to the stand, who enabled him, these people who are part of this ecosystem of abuse. And I'm hoping that in Chicago, there'll be, you know, some consequences for the enablers.
Graham Hampton, we want to thank you so much for your work, for your films, for your documentary series on Showtime called Surviving R, on Lifetime called Surviving R. Kelly. Dream Hampton is a filmmaker as well as a writer and the executive producer of that series. When we come back, we go inside the CIA's secret plans to kill or kidnap Julian Assange. Stay with us. Thousand Eyes by FKA Twigs. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Did the CIA, under President Trump, plan to kidnap and assassinate WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange during a shootout in London? That's one of the explosive findings in a new exposé by Yahoo News. The report details how the CIA considered abducting and possibly murdering Assange while he took refuge in the Ecuadorian embassy in London to avoid being extradited to Sweden, charges that were dropped in 2017 in Sweden. More than 30 former officials described how then-CIA Director Mike Pompeo was apparently motivated to get even with WikiLeaks following its publication of sensitive CIA hacking tools called Vault 7, which the agency considered the largest data loss in CIA history. One official said Pompeo and others, quote, were completely detached from reality because they were so embarrassed about Vault 7, they were seeing blood, unquote. For more, we're joined in Washington, D.C. by one of the three reporters on this story. Mike Isikoff is chief investigative correspondent for Yahoo News, where he's also editor-at-large for reporting and investigations. Michael Isikoff, welcome back to Democracy Now! This is just an explosive story. Can you lay out your findings? You spoke with scores, your team, of people in intelligence. Lay out the scene from before 2017 on.
Right. This was one of the most contentious intelligence debates of the entire Trump era. And it really starts with that Vault 7 leak. As is well known, WikiLeaks had been on the radar screen of U.S. intelligence for years, going back to its publications, in 2010 of the State Department cables, the Afghan war logs and Iraq war logs that had been provided by Chelsea Manning, and of course Assange's role in publishing the Russian purloined DNC emails and Podesta emails during the 2016 election. But what really set Mike Pompeo, the new CIA director, off was that Vault 7 leak. This was on his watch, this was his agency, and while Pompeo had been somewhat dismissive of the Russia allegations and Assange's role in that, the Vault 7 leak focused his energies on getting back at WikiLeaks and Assange, at dismantling the organization. I was in the room when Pompeo gave that speech in early April 2017, where he described for the first time WikiLeaks as a non-state hostile intelligence service. I thought and assumed, like many, it was some kind of rhetorical talking point, a grabby line that Pompeo had come up with. In fact, that designation internally opened the door for the CIA to launch and plan all sorts of operations that didn't require a presidential finding and didn't and wasn't going to be briefed to Capitol Hill. These were offensive counterintelligence activities. Pompeo, there's abduction plans to basically a snatch operation to take Assange from the Ecuadorian embassy. There was talk of assassination, although we want to be clear, that never was forwarded to the White House. That was internally within the CIA. The abduction plans were, as part of a much broader, multi-pronged CIA attack on WikiLeaks that included stealing computers, surveillance of WikiLeaks associates, sowing discord among its members, and Trump White House lawyers raised concerns that Pompeo had gone further than was legally authorized. For one thing, at the time that the CIA was developing these plans, there was still no indictment by the Justice Department of Assange. So it raised the question, if you abducted him, rendered him, where would you take him? On what grounds could you hold him in custody, without an indictment? This spurs the White House to get on the Justice Department's back and try to get them to accelerate an indictment of Assange, which finally comes in late 2017.
So Michael, you talk about the differences between the Justice Department and the CIA on this, and also clearly, as you mentioned, these were more in the lines of scenarios because the plans never got a go ahead, certainly not from the Trump White House, because Trump had been praising WikiLeaks in essence helping him in his election campaign with their release of documents.
Absolutely. We all remember, I love WikiLeaks from the 2016 campaign. And one note I should point out that in our piece, we got a statement from Trump, because we had a source who said that when Trump was finally briefed on this, he raised the question of, can you assassinate Assange? Trump, in a statement to Yahoo News just last week that's in the piece, denied that, but then said something really interesting. He said, Assange is being treated very badly. He's basically reverted to the 2016 position of, I love WikiLeaks, expressing sympathy, no doubt, for what Assange did during the 2016 election.
So let's go to that famous comment of President Trump declaring how he loved WikiLeaks.
This just came out. WikiLeaks, I love WikiLeaks.
But then we go back to 2017 when Mike Pompeo was director of the Central Intelligence Agency.
Hawks, like a hostile intelligence service, and has encouraged its followers to find jobs at the CIA in order to obtain intelligence. It directed Chelsea Manning in her theft of specific secret information. It overwhelmingly focuses on the United States while seeking support from anti-democratic countries and organizations. It's time to call out WikiLeaks for what it really is, a non-state hostile intelligence service often abetted by state actors like Russia.
Julian Assange later responded to the allegation in an interview with Jeremy Scahill on his podcast, Intercepted.
Pompeo has stated that WikiLeaks instructed Chelsea Manning to go after certain information. That's an interesting revelation. And then there is his statement that this, i.e. WikiLeaks and its publications, end now. So how does he propose to conduct this ending? He didn't say, but the CIA is only in the business of collecting information, kidnapping people and assassinating people. So it's quite a menacing statement that he does need to clarify.
So that's Julian Assange, and he's laying it out right there. If the CIA is in the business of assassinating or kidnapping people, and Pompeo started by saying WikiLeaks walks like a hostile intelligence service and talks like a hostile intelligence service, the key part there. So I wanted to ask you about the scene you lay out. Outside a place we have been to a number of times interviewing Julian Assange before he was in Belmarsh, the prison where he is held right now, waiting extradition case, what the British government will determine whether they'll send him to the United States. We've interviewed him a number of times in the Ecuadorian embassy. You describe the actual picture, the people. It's right next to Harrods in London. But at one point, the number of intelligence agencies basically made up all of the people posing as whoever outside the embassy.
Yeah, everybody within a three-block radius, we were told, was likely working for one intelligence service or another. There is a sort of second phase of all this that's in which that comes up, and that is later in 2000. And I should point out, the abduction rendition plans never got the approval from the Trump White House. Trump White House lawyers raised objections. They even went to the Hill, raised concerns about some of what Pompeo was up to. But some of what Pompeo was planning and the CIA was planning did go through, and that includes audio and visual surveillance of Assange from inside the Ecuadorian embassy and monitoring of the communications and travels of Assange associates. So aspects of the war on WikiLeaks that Pompeo was declaring did get implemented, and that's confirmed for the first time, although there have been lots of allegations to this effect. This is confirmed for the first time in our piece. But later in 2017, the U.S. intelligence community gets information it views as credible that Russian operatives are on the ground in London preparing to spirit Assange out of the embassy and onto a plane and fly him to Moscow. And this is when things really get ramped up. The Trump White House at the highest levels get involved in planning and overseeing all sorts of plans and scenarios to thwart the feared Russian escape of Assange from the embassy. There were discussions about a potential gun battle on the streets of London. This was done in consultation with British authorities, who made it clear that if there was going to be any shooting, they would do it. There was also plans for stopping the Russian aircraft from taking off from the United Kingdom, plans to shoot the tires on the airplane, have helicopters stationed to hover over to prevent the airplane from taking off. There was a lot of wild Jason Bourne stuff going on to prevent what U.S. officials feared was going to be a Russian-assisted escape from the embassy.
And Michael, I'm just wondering, I mean, the revelations in your article are shocking, but they shouldn't be surprising given the history of the CIA, whether it's Patrice Lumumba or the hunt for Che Guevara, or the CIA has always been in the business of these assassinations and renditions. But doesn't it really lay to rest any doubt that what has been happening to Julian Assange all of these years from the original Swedish charges was really being engineered by the United States' effort to get him as a result of the WikiLeaks disclosures?
Well, there's certainly lots of questions raised by all this. I mean, whether the Swedish charges can be put on the CIA, I don't have any information to back that up. But certainly, I think there's going to be already sort of calls for an investigation into this, certainly questions for the CIA. But also, I think most immediately, there's this extradition case before the British courts, and every indication that there are folks, including Assange's legal team, that want to bring some of this to the attention of the British courts as grounds for blocking the extradition of Assange to a country, some of whose officials were talking about kidnapping and assassinating him not too many years ago. Whether that works or not, I don't know. The British courts have a very narrow brief on this, and that is the ruling by the British judge blocking the extradition was over the risk of suicide that Assange would face were he sent to prison. So whether the appeal by the Merrick Garland, Joe Biden Justice Department of that adverse ruling can be expanded to include some of these allegations, we're going to find out very soon.
So let me ask you about Jeff Sessions, who was the Attorney General at the time, had, to say the least, extremely anti-Julian Assange, but very opposed to the CIA because he thought they would mess up the ability to extradite him and compared it to Dan Ellsberg.
Sure. And listen, I mean, some of this is sort of institutional, bureaucratic, you know, turf protections. The Justice Department doesn't want the intelligence agencies mucking around on their cases in ways that could jeopardize the prosecution. And you mentioned Daniel Ellsberg. That's interesting because when I spoke to Barry Pollack, the U.S. lawyer for Assange over the weekend, that's one of the first things he raised, that, you know, this could be evident if Assange is extradited and brought to an American courtroom, his American lawyers would raise government misconduct as grounds for dismissal. And as Pollack pointed out, that's Daniel Ellsberg's lawyers succeeded on that very grounds. Ellsberg was being prosecuted leaking Pentagon papers. And then when evidence came out about some of what the Nixon White House was planning and did, and, you know, in one case breaking into a psychiatrist's office, that was grounds for tossing the indictment. Whether the Assange, whether that parallel will work for Assange, we'll have to wait and see. You know, clearly some of these more extreme measures weren't implemented, but some, including the surveillance of Assange from inside the embassy when he may have been talking to his lawyers or doctors and other having other privileged conversations, that could factor into a government misconduct motion.
We want to bring in one of Julian Assange's legal advisors, Jen Robinson, but first have her respond to Al Jazeera English White House correspondent Kimberly Halkett questioning White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki Friday about the charges against WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange and why Biden is persisting.
Why is President Biden keeping the Trump-era charges against Julian Assange? Why is he allowing the prosecution from publishing the truth about human rights abuses in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Guantanamo? And does the president believe the ongoing detention of Assange is reasonable, even moral, given the transparency delivered and the greater good served?
Well, I don't have anything new to say on the Julian Assange, and I would point you to the Department of Justice on that. I would say, though, that we do think of ourselves, and we are approaching this from an entirely different approach of the last few years as it relates to freedom of the press. And I think the Department of Justice's actions as it relates to the prosecution of journalists or how we're going to look at or go after records, something that the Attorney General made an announcement about, the President has spoken to, is very clear evidence of exactly that.
Does the President see this as a freedom of press issue with respect to Assange?
Again, I have nothing new to speak to on Julian
this
Assange.
This is something that I emailed you about months ago, so there's been time to
I understand. I don't have a new comment from here.
So that's Jen Psaki, the White House Press spokesperson, responding to Al Jazeera English White House correspondent Kimberly Halkett. Jen Robinson is with us from Australia, a longtime legal advisor and human rights attorney for Julian Assange. Can you talk about the new information that we are getting from Yahoo, this explosive information about the possibility of kidnapping or assassinating him, something Julian talked about himself, and what this means for his case right now? As he sits in the Belmarsh maximum security prison.
Thanks, Amy. Well, of course, the Yahoo revelations are incredibly important, and what a brilliant piece of journalism. But this is just the latest shocking revelation. This is the CIA talking about conspiracy to kidnap and murder an Australian citizen and an award-winning journalist and editor who has done nothing but publish truthful information about the United States and about war crimes, human rights abuse, and corruption the world over. Any American citizen and journalists and editors the world over ought to be very concerned about these revelations about the conduct of the FBI, the CIA, and their proposals with respect to WikiLeaks. Now, This was something that was warned back in 2017. As soon as Mike Pompeo made this announcement that WikiLeaks was going to be considered by the CIA as a hostile non-state intelligence agency, we were very concerned, and in fact I warned immediately that this would lay the groundwork for unprecedented and unlawful actions by the CIA against WikiLeaks. And that's precisely what we've seen, and that's precisely what Yahoo's latest revelations show us. But this is nothing new. We have put evidence before the extradition challenge in London of unlawful spying by UC Global inside the Ecuadorian embassy on Julian, his doctors, on us as his lawyers, and there were in fact materials gathered, video materials of us having confidential conversations with our client, legally privileged material, which has been shared with US intelligence agencies. Now, this is clearly unlawful activity, and as my US co-counsel Barry Pollack has said, should be sufficient to close this down. Now, if the Biden administration was legitimately changing its position on the First Amendment and the protection of journalists, there is a principled reason to close this investigation down because of the First Amendment consequences. But this is also evidence of unlawful conduct in the context of this investigation, which gives further ground for the Biden administration to close this down, and that's precisely what they should do.
We want to thank you so much for being with us, Jennifer Robinson, attorney advising Julian Assange and WikiLeaks, and also Michael Isikoff, chief investigative correspondent for Yahoo News. We'll link to his piece, Kidnapping, Assassination, and the London Shootout Inside the CIA's War Plans Against WikiLeaks. Next up, we go to Chicago. Find out why workers at El Milagro tortilla plant staged a temporary walkout. Stay with us.
Throwing off sparks of pure power, sending signals from a mystery tower. You didn't bother making sure it was sinking. It was a different way of working and thinking. Really wild and completely expressive. So creative and intense and obsessive. You were practically completely beyond it, and you were exactly just what nobody wanted. You were conscious and responsive and present. You weren't trying to make something unpleasant. You were just bouncing off of things that were trashy. And it was never very tricky or flashy. You had a vision that was clear and
exactly ready. What Nobody Wanted by Jeffrey Lewis and The Voltage. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We end today's show in Chicago, where workers at El Milagro tortilla plant staged a temporary walkout to protest low pay, staff shortages, and abuse of working conditions, including intimidation and sexual harassment. When they returned to work, they discovered management had locked them out in retaliation. This is El Milagro worker Irma Gonzalez.
They didn't let us go back to work. We had our personal belongings inside the plant. In my case, I'm pregnant. My medicine was still inside, and they denied us entry. This is not fair. We are simply fighting for our rights. We're not trying to harm the company.
El Milagro claims an ongoing tortilla shortage is due to supply chain issues, but organizers say the company's lost staff due to their poor treatment of workers, including their mishandling of the pandemic. Last year, dozens of workers got sick during a COVID outbreak. Five died. This is another El Milagro worker, Martin Salas.
I pack 80 tortilla packages per minute. I load a case, put it on a pallet, and come right back. Because if I don't keep up this pace, tortillas will fall off from the machine and they'll blame me.
Workers have given El Milagro management until end of day Wednesday to respond to their demands. The company was founded in Chicago in 1950 by Raul Lopez, a Mexican immigrant, and sells tortillas around the country. For more, we go to Chicago to speak with Jorge Mujica, strategic campaigns organizer at Arise Chicago. Jorge, you've been working closely with the workers for several years. Can you talk about what the demands are and what will happen on Wednesday?
Yes, thank you very much. Good morning. On Wednesday, nothing yet, because we gave, or the workers gave, the company a deadline to the end of the day. But on Thursday, surely the workers are going to come back and demand answers from the company. Their main demands are a fair wage scale, because the company is paying only 40 cents above minimum wage, and at the same time is advertising new jobs for $16, so 60 cents above people who have been working there for 10, 15, 20, and 25 years. That's the most important demand. They say the El Milagro needs to attract new workers, and that is only going to happen if they increase the wages. And the other one is definitely to reduce the speed of the machines. What the workers are telling us is that the company, instead of offering better wages and hiring more people, is just cranking up the machines. So they have to pack 80 packages per minute. I mean, less than 1 second to pack 12 tortillas, put it in a paper envelope, and stack them in the boxes. So that's insane. They say, okay, they increase the speed of the machines, but they can't increase our speed. We are not machines. So they want to put a stop on that.
And Jorge, could you talk, for people who are not familiar with El Milagro, the importance of this facility and the plants that it has in the Mexican-American community? El Milagro tortillas are famous throughout Chicago in the Midwest, and the fact that it's largely a Mexican ownership as well.
Yes, they are the most famous and largest tortilla maker in the Midwest. If you go by one of the plants, they have 5 plants and 3 restaurants. If you go to one of the plants at 4 o'clock in the morning, you would see trucks lining up from Ohio, from Iowa, from Wisconsin, Wisconsin, Michigan. I mean, this is amazing. Millions of tortillas every day. They are incredibly famous. They are good, and they are good because the workers really, put their best effort to produce these tortillas. And this is family-owned. Just one family controls the whole consortium, and they are still, with practices belonging in the 1970s and the 1980s. They only buy a couple new machines every year, but conditions are really awful. This is a sweatshop.
And last year, over 80 of the employees came down with COVID and 5 died. What kind of a health and safety protocols were they using there?
Not at all. And we have a couple pretty much criminal behaviors there, where they forbade workers to wear face masks. They told them that the workforce was going to feel unstable if they saw anybody wearing a face mask. So they didn't allow anyone to do it for a while until, of course, diseases spread and people started dying. And then they shut down one of the 5 plants to clean it up. But as we told the workers last year, the machines don't sneeze. This is people to people, person to person contagion. So the workers got up together and imposed, some basic precautions. And then down the line, the company decided to respect social distancing, etc. But this is a crowded space. It's designed for production. It's not designed as any other production space. It's not designed to take care of people's health. It's designed to produce merchandise and get money.
Jorge, can you...
And what about the sexual harassment allegations as well?
There are several sexual harassment accusations. Workers complain that they have denounced this to management, and what management does is to move the supervisor from one plant to the next one, instead of solving the problem, instead of training their supervisors, instead of raising really good standards.
And Jorge, can you talk about what happened to the workers after they had their rally last week? We just played Irma Gonzalez talking about being pregnant and being locked out of the plant. She couldn't get her medication. What the plans are for tomorrow, for Wednesday?
Yeah, well, we had to call the police, and the police came and opened up the plant to allow the workers to get their personal belongings. And the next day, we went with the workers to report to Human Resources, and Human Resources simply gave up, saying, we will pay you for the hours you lost yesterday in the lockout. So it was a round victory for workers. What the workers are demanding now is the plant, the management, to sit down with them. The management just hired a union buster to go and talk to them about how bad unions are. And what the workers say is, we are not talking about unions. We are talking about decency. We are talking about wages. We are talking about the heat in the workplace. They work at 95 degrees, including their meal time, you know, in the lunchroom, 95 degrees. That's what we want to talk about to management, not to a union busting company.
Jorge Mujico, we want to thank you so much for being with us. Strategic campaigns organizer at Arise Chicago, working closely with the El Milagro workers. And that does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is currently accepting applications for two positions, Director of Finance Administration and Human Resources Manager. Learn more and apply at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Produced with Renee Fels, Mike Burke, Dina Geisler, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Teresena, Tammy Warren, Afterina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari, A Studio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Honey Miss. Dude, I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Hi, this is Greg Keeler with Blue Rodeo here, 88.3 FM, WRCT, Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
Hear my song as I ride along, I'm just a happy roving cowboy. Let me sing my song till they call me home to a land beyond the blue.
Hello there, neighbor. It's health and happiness time with the old lovesick blues boy, Hank Williams, Miss Audrey, and all the drifting cowboys. Yes, a singing sensation of the country. Hank Williams is back again for a little visit and some good news that'll make you mighty glad you tuned in.
I ain't got a dime just wasting my time. I'm just a happy roving cowboy. Let me sing my song till they call me home to a land beyond the blue.
Yes, neighbors, here's one of the things that makes your radio worthwhile. You're always glad to spend a little money on the juice when this fella comes calling around. It's our old friend, Hank Williams!
Thank you, Grant. Thank you a lot. And welcome, friends and neighbors, to another Health and Happiness Show. We hope you all are good and healthy and happy and feeling good. All the boys and myself, Miss Audrey, Grant Turner, we all here to try to make you happy for the next few minutes. I'd like to start off here with a song that I recorded here not long ago. I think it's one of the prettiest ones I've ever recorded. Boys, if you will, a little tune called The Lost Highway. I'm a rolling stone, all alone and lost. For a life of sin, I have paid the cost. When I pass by, all the people say, there goes another boy down the lost highway. Just a deck of cards and a jug of wine, and a woman's lies make a life like mine. For the day we met, I went astray. I started rolling down that lost highway. I was just a lad, nearly 22. Neither good nor bad, just a kid like you. And now I'm lost, too late to pray. Lord, I've paid the cost on the lost highway. Now, boys, don't start your rambling around on this road of sin, or you're sorrow bound. Take my advice, or you curse the day you started rolling down that lost highway.